Welcome to the podcast, everybody. Got a very close friend, big time director. He's our guest this week. Before we get to it, a couple little things off the top of my head. You want to get the oatmeal squares. It's a cereal. You want to eat it without milk. You just pop them in your mouth. They're great little snacks, and they're pretty sturdy. You could probably prop up a chair with them too. Very dense, and they digest fine. Don't worry about that. Listen, I'm watching the 16th inning of a game between the Red Sox and the Yankees. This is too much. So I say by the 11th, the two most out-of-shape guys who don't really play a lot on each team have to meet at the mound and play Jenga. Whoever wins the Jenga game wins the game. I can't do this anymore. They're literally getting a 90-year-old woman who sells sausage and peppers outside Fenway to pitch next. I use less chapstick these days. I'm not sure why. My lips are the same. Maybe it's global warming. I don't know. But I just thought I'd let you know that. And I just feel, I feel like the Last Supper had to be tense. I was thinking about the Last Supper. I don't know how you eat at the Last Supper. I don't know how you chit-chat at the, it'd be a very awkward conversation. Oh, I'd complain. Fish again? We get it. You can multiply the fish. Just a thought. So listen, enjoy my buddy Don Scardino. Great director. You know him. You've seen his work as a director on 30 Rock. Incredible. The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. And countless other things. The film with Steve Carell. The incredible Burt Wonderstone. And just a fantastic director who has worked with some of the biggest stars, Alec Baldwin, Tina Fey, you name it. Real great insight into a guy who has been directing for years and is a master of his craft. And we talk about how many things, but including how he does what he does and does so well. So enjoy it. Thanks for checking out the podcast. If you have anything you want me to bitch and complain about for you, email me. PaulTalks1@gmail.com. PaulTalks1@gmail.com, and I'll talk about it. PaulTalks1@gmail.com. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Please send it around to your friends. We're building great numbers. We want to keep that up. I'm here with a very, very, very good friend, a very dear friend, and a very nice human being, Don Scardino.
Tell him we dated in high school.
Oh man, it was the best. But then you cheated on me, and it was never the same. Emmy winner for outstanding comedy, producing the 30 Rock, the great Tina Fey show. Director has directed, you name it, he's directed it. The incredible Burt Wonderstone. Name some others.
I directed A Few Good Men on Broadway.
There you go.
I directed The Cosby Show. I directed Law and Order, the first, 14 seasons. I direct Two Broke Girls. I've been doing that for the last few years, but we just got canceled.
And The Incredible Kimmy Schmidt, which is
Kimmy
out
Schmidt,
now.
Yeah.
And
I directed Traffic on my way over. It was very... It was very crowded. I had to move it along.
You can't help. But you were an actor, too. We're shooting this in CBS at the CBS studios on 57th between 10th and 11th.
That's right.
And in 1965, you were an actor in this building in what?
I'm dating myself. Yeah, I was on The Guiding Light. I was a teenage ne'er-do-well. And there was it was live. It was 15 minutes long. It was black and white. And it was in this very building. And then it went to color, half hour, and on tape in the 2 years that I was playing Johnny Fletcher.
Johnny Fletcher?
Johnny Fletcher.
And who was Johnny
Fletcher? Mr. Fletcher's son. I was a bad kid. You know, my father was the star of the soap opera. He had, not my real father, I mean my character father, and he had remarried, and I was bugged, and, you know, so I was just a problem. I fell in love with a girl. I made the girl's father have a heart attack. I fought him. You know, it was wild, yeah.
But you were like, was it, you were four, you got your card, your equity card at 12 or 14?
14, yeah.
And your parents are both musicians.
Right.
Jazz musicians.
Right.
So you saw them and you were five, I think, and you said to yourself, that I want to be something like that in terms of a performer,
live performer? Yeah, yeah, yeah. They took me, you know, most kids when they're five decide they want to be a fireman
right,
or something.
Exactly.
You know, me, no.
Or a cop directing traffic.
That's right. I'm close. So I went, my downstairs neighbor went to the High School of Performing Arts, and she was in Kismet at the Paper Mill Playhouse. Mm-hmm. My parents take me and my brothers to see her, our downstairs neighbor, dance around at the Paper Mill Playhouse in Kismet.
It was your babysitter Judy, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
My babysitter Judy.
I thought, it's Judy. It could be me. He besieged his parents. I want to be a musketeer. I want to be in The Sound of Music.
Where'd you get that?
I did a little research. It's the least I could do.
That's true. I just went, oh my God, you know, babysitters do this. So I could do this. Yeah. My babysitter could, can't I? And yeah, and then I just bugged my
parents. But at five,
parents.
To have that presence, like at five, I had the attention span of a gnat, right? Like, okay, that was good. Can I get ice cream? And you just, clicked.
I zeroed in. I mean, I don't know why, you know.
Now, do you remember at that time, I imagine you saw your parents perform.
Well, my parents were jazz musicians. I went to see them play a lot.
Yeah.
My mom would sit at the piano and sing. And my dad played bass and was a band leader.
And do you remember anything that hitting you and going, wow, that's...
Well, what I do remember is that, you know, they were special. They were on the stage. If I went to Roseland, they were on the bandstand. If I went to the Waldorf Astoria, they were on the bandstand. You know, if they were playing some famous singer or, you know, Gregory Hines and his dad. He used to play Hines and Dad a lot. And so I would make that connection, which is that, oh, regular people do this. My mom and dad do this. You know, I can bridge that gap. I can be on the stage side of things.
Right.
So it wasn't a mystery in a way, in that way.
And so then at five, now you get to first grade, second grade, are you trying at school plays or what's happening to get you so quickly to...
School plays. I put shows on in my basement.
Did you really?
Sure. Had the whole neighborhood came in. I did Sound of Music when I was nine. Mom, enchanted evening. It was ridiculous.
And so you're producing, directing, and acting at the age of seven, eight,
designing
nine.
Sets, doing makeup, everything. And and so I just kept...
A New Yorker, by the way. Native New Yorker.
Native New Yorker, born in Queens.
Right.
And then I saw the Mouseketeers. That was the era of the Mickey Mouse Club. And then I saw these kids on TV, and I went, oh, wait a minute, you know, they're hardly older than me. Why can't I do that? So then I drove them crazy. One day my father put $90 on the table and an ad from the New York Times that said, $90 to L.A. I said, here you go, you want to go? And my mother saying, oh, don't be cruel, Pa. And he said, here, go ahead, it's $90. That's what it costs. Go ahead. I can't by myself. I can't go by myself.
But I'm surprised, but they had to be supportive of it because, I mean, they're performers in their own right, so they understand.
Yeah, yeah, right? they got it. You know, and also, you know, my mom and dad, their philosophy was, you know, you can do what you love. You can grow up and do what you love. Look at us. We play music. We've always loved music. We make a living, you know, doing what we love.
And did you, so once you finished high school, obviously, but...
Barely.
You knew, like, this acting thing was it.
Yeah.
Directing obviously comes later.
Yeah.
How hard was it to break into acting and soap operas at the time? Because that was a big thing then, right?
I mean, yeah.
Those were like, that was, that it wasn't just like anybody walks in off the street and gets one of those.
No, that's right. You know, when I was 12, I guess, I went to the High School of Performing Arts, right? And that was, then at the time it was at 46th Street between 6th and 7th. And I used to get show business backstage in Variety, and they all had the casting notices.
Right.
And I would go on my lunch hour, or I'd cut class, and I would go to these casting calls. And what happened was I got a Critics' Choice with Hans Conried. It was the end of the tour. They needed a kid. The other kid, I don't know, you know, grew too big for the clothes or something. I don't know. But they needed a kid. And I went to the audition, lied, saying I was in Equity. Already.
Explain to people listening what that means.
Well, Actors Equity Association is the union, the guild for actors on the stage in New York. And if you're in an Actors Equity production, that would be Broadway, off-Broadway, Class A stock at the time, you had to be a member of Equity. So even to audition for these things, you had to show your Equity card and say, I'm a member of Equity. Then you couldn't get in. So I went to this audition because I read about it in the paper, and I go in, and they say, you're an Equity member? I said, yes. Where's your card? Oh, gee, I left it at home. And I went in, I read for it, and I got it. And so then I had to go to Equity in that day and time.
Now, do your parents know in your lunch break you're going and doing this?
No, they didn't know.
Wow.
They didn't know. So then I had to go to Equity with my contract and say, I have an Equity contract I have to join. So it was like a catch-22. You couldn't get an Equity show without being in Equity, but you couldn't get an Equity. You had to be Equity to get an Equity contract. So I got the contract. That got me into Equity, and I went and did my first. So I went home to my mom and dad and said, I got the job. They said, what are you talking about? I said, and it's in Louisville, Kentucky, because it was the end of the tour. What do you mean? I said, I'm going to Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh.
I was 12. I said, you're not going to Louisville, Kentucky. You know, yes, I am. I have the contract. I signed the contract. You can't sign the contract. You're 12. And so...
No, none of the adults in this process stopped and said, you have to get your parents involved. They're just like, they're just dealing with you.
Yeah, show business. Kids are like 40. You know, 12-year-olds are 40 when they're in show business. Yeah, I talked to Merrick the other day. You know, the weirdest kids in the world are in show business, or at least at that point in time. So they finally handled my oldest brother, who was, you know, older than me. He was working at NBC, as a matter of fact, and he was like 20 or 21, to come down there with me.
So you went?
Yeah, you damn right I went. I would have murdered my parents. I went, you know, and I had a great time, and I went, this is it, you know. And then I don't know how I got the Guiding Light, but I think I came back from Critics' Choice, and I got a list of Equity franchised agents from Actors Equity. There were about 25 of them. They were all in the Midtown area. And I, again, on my lunch hour in school, I'd go and go, hi, my name is Don Scardino. I bring my picture and my little resume that said now Critics' Choice on it.
Wow.
Instead of just, you know,
plays in my
basement. Rumpelstiltskin. Yeah, right. So I got an agent. The agent got me an audition for The Guiding Light. So when I was 14 or 15, I was on The Guiding Light.
And training, formal training?
Well, at the High School of Performing Arts, you know, the drama, it was a drama school, music school, and a dance school. But what happened was when they found out I was working, they said, you can't work and study. You have to leave.
Wait, they kick you out of the school that's trained to get you?
That's right. That's just what I said. I said, but I'm doing what you... You're teaching
me. Why do you
me.
Have I'm to getting, leave?
You have to leave. You're not allowed to be a professional. You have to study, and then when you leave the high school, then you can do what you
want. That's so ridiculous.
Go figure. So I had to go. I had to leave. So then I went to Quintano School for Young Professionals, which was a school where the Tokens were there. You know, in the jungle, the mighty jungle.
Oh.
Tokens were all teenagers from Long Island. So they were there. The Walken Brothers. We knew them as the Dancing Walkens. Chris Walken, Ronnie Walken. Ronnie Walken became Chris Walken.
Right.
Glenn Walken was his brother, and there was another Walken. I can't remember the third.
Were they
tap dancing kids?
Were they a little odd then, or was he a little odd then?
He was just one of the funniest kids you ever want to meet.
Really?
He just had this wacky sense of humor, and you know.
But he was a dancer from the age of little kid.
Of little,
wow.
Yeah.
And the Guiding Light kept you from being one of the monkeys.
That's
right?
True. Yeah, you did do that. You did. Or did I tell you that before?
No, I read that.
I was on the Guiding Light. I had signed up. I was a couple of months into the contract.
God, that must have been a ball buster not being able to do that.
Yeah.
So, sorry,
it was actually later. It was towards the end of my contract. But...
For those of you listening who don't know the Monkees were, there was the Beatles, and then this group came along that sort of... replicated the Beatles and the look and whatever, but they were very good musicians in their own right, and they had a really fun, funny
TV show
that sort of in the spirit of a Hard Day's Night or whatever, you know, kind of followed them around, and they would play as part of the show. And
totally.
But you're under contract at CBS.
So they're going to form this band, put this band together, Don Kirshner and whoever else was producing. I go in and audition for it like I audition for anything, particularly guitar, because I play guitar.
Yeah, this guy's a juggernaut. He's like a five-tool player in baseball, right? He can act, he can sing, he can play the guitar.
Sure, and direct traffic.
Direct traffic.
So I audition, I bring my guitar, I sing some songs, they ask me a bunch of questions, they want to see if I'm, you know, ad-lib funny and blah, blah, blah. And then I get a call back. They say, bring your band. I didn't have a band, so I put together a bunch of kids. who could play, and I said, "Here's my band," and we went up there.
Did you guys like learn a song together?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
A couple of tunes. We did I Should Have Known Better from Hard Day's Night, and then there was a song that a guitar player kid had written. So I went, actually, it was Barry Pearl, who was Duty in Grease in the movie, who became Duty in Grease in the movie later. But anyway, so we go up there and we sing this stuff, and then they again sit me down. They're filming now, doing, you know, the interview. And then I get a call. You got it. You're the first one cast. You're going to be the American Beatles. You're going to be one of the Monkees.
Jesus.
I was like over the moon.
They must have seen thousands of kids too, right?
They did, all over the country, apparently.
Wow.
So I thought, this is great. This is great. And then, you know, my agent says, Matt, we got a snag here. You're still under contract for another like 4 or 5 months to the Guiding Light, and Procter & Gamble won't let you go. Unless they can have the right to a first right of refusal to sponsor the show, at which point Screen Gems, which head of the show, said, "Nah, we can't give that away. We're just making the pilot." So, I didn't become a Monkee. But the good news is, you know, I'd either be hawking hits of the '60s in late night television right now,
with a comb over,
I'd be dead, you know, from, you know, drug abuse. I don't know, something, you know. It'd be
Was that tough to get your head around at the time, though? Did you feel like, oh, this is a lost opportunity?
At first, it was like, oh God, you know. And then the director of the Guiding Light, who actually was very smart, very prescient, a guy named Walter Gorman, said to me, "What do you want to be, Pappy?" He called me Pappy. He said, "What do you want to be, Pappy? You want to be a serious actor? You know, you want to really go the distance, or do you want to be known as this? Because if this does what they think it's going to do, you're going to be known as this."
Yeah.
And that's true, because I know Mickey Dolenz now, and, you know, he's had a hard time. He wants to be an actor and wants to do Broadway shows and stuff like that. And
still to this day.
Yeah, but he's the Monkees.
That,
you know,
hangs on him.
Yeah. So, you know, in the long run, you know, when the show came on the air, it won a bunch of Emmys, and the records went bang, bang to number one. They were hot stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was depressing, but for a while. But, you know, I mean, but I had an ongoing career. I kept working, you know, I kept doing stuff. So I figured, all right, well, that's the way it goes.
Do you, when you're a kid and you're acting, it's almost like most things when you're a kid, you don't know better than you. So you stay out of your own head. I think it's like with kids with golf, like they just go up and whack the ball and they don't.
Yeah.
Were you able to maintain that once you became an adult and you started to realize, there's stuff riding on this. I've got to support myself. I got bills to pay. You get in your own head.
Absolutely. That's what happened. You know, I've been acting since I was a kid. Then I'm 18, 19, I'm acting. And then these kids are coming out of college. They come from Carnegie Mellon or NYU and whatever. Yeah. And they have all this technique and they have all this stuff they studied. And I'm thinking, I don't know that. I just went 1, 2, 3, go.
Yeah. You
know, like Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
You know, it's just do it. I'm a kid. You know, yeah. You want me to cry? I'll cry in a second. You know, because I'm a kid.
Yeah.
So suddenly I thought, oh, I missed something here. You know, and then I started to get in my own head like, oh, I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm going by the natch.
Oh,
and
really?
I gotta get some of that, you know,
yeah,
college acting stuff.
Yeah. And so did that get in the way a little bit, but then you were able to work through it? I mean,
yeah.
you ended up, another big thing you did was Godspell. You did like 1,000.
Over 1,000 performances shows. Jesus.
As Jesus, nonetheless,
yes,
who else would it be other than Jesus? A thousand and
crucified eight times a week is no picnic, let me tell you. Yeah.
What a day. I got crucified again.
Yeah, two show day, Saturday, Sunday. Oh, man, twice.
Home. I've already gotten crucified. I can't hear your complaining. But that was up in Canada. I mean, you met Paul Schaefer.
Yeah.
In Canada,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
And I'm still friends with him to this day, and he was just performing on your show I saw a few months ago, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
But tell people about how you guys came to know each other.
Well, I had been working up in Canada. I did a movie up there, and I did some other things, and I loved it. I was staying there. And then a fellow that I knew slightly, because he had been in a movie with me, named Victor Garber. Great actor. Said, I'm doing this musical up here. It's a big hit in New York, and it's called Godspell. And he said, don't come near the theater. I said, what? He said, well, you're perfect for this. They'll fire me. Don't come near the theater. So,
Now, why did he think you were perfect for it?
I don't know. He just did.
You don't look like
the traditional
skinny Jew. You don't look like malnourished Jew.
No, well, you know, the Godspell concept of Jesus is a clown.
Yeah, oh, okay.
So there you go, you know.
Yeah, there's actually a shot of you with clown makeup on in some of the research that I saw. But yeah, so he says, don't come.
So he said, don't come to the theater. Anyway, so I my wife and I, at the time, my wife and I go back to New York. I'm done with my Canadian stint. Mm. We go back to New York, and I said, I'm going to check this Godspell out. And I go to see Godspell, and it's amazing. It was playing off Broadway. It had just opened a couple months earlier. Amazing show. And then I get this call from Victor saying, I got the movie of Godspell. And this is a great company of people, and I don't want to leave them in the lurch. So I've told them, you're the guy to replace me.
Wow.
Now, as it turned out, because I've been working in Canada, I had my landed immigrant papers because I'd gotten them because I was going to stay and work.
Mm.
So I had the papers. I could go up. Stephen Schwartz had seen me audition for Pippin and wanted me to play Pippin, but Bob Fosse wanted the other guy. I didn't get it. But Schwartz remembered me and said, yeah, cast him. Just send him up there. Mm-hmm. So I go up now, and that company of kids was Marty Short, Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, Gilda Radner.
All in Godspell?
All in Godspell. All kids, all starting out fresh. Paul Schaefer on the keyboards. Dave Thomas was an understudy. Remember Dave Thomas?
Wow. But they had come out of Second City? Or
no,
not yet.
Not yet.
Oh, this is on the front
yeah,
side.
Marty
of
had done
oh
one show.
God,
he had done Good Man Charlie Brown, I think.
I mean, I knew there was a people, but I didn't know it was on the front side.
Yeah, it was Bald before.
And
before they were great.
And did you see glimpses of what they would become
totally,
even then?
Totally. Well, Eugene and Marty, Eugene Levy and Marty Short, they were like a comedy team. You know, they were hilarious together,
yeah.
And they would feed off each other, and they would improv on stage, and. You just thought, you know, these kids are all so special. They're all going to go. Andrea Martin was hilarious. Gilda Radner was, you know, just so vulnerable and funny and original. And, you know, you just... And, of course, Schaefer was a genius even then. And my mom, who was, a great jazz pianist, when she heard him play, when she came up to see the show in Toronto, she said, who is that kid? I mean, that guy plays like Art Tatum. You know, and he was 20.
Wow.
You know.
And... That was over 1,000 performances.
Well, so I did Toronto, and then I was up in Toronto for a couple of months, and then they came to me and said, we need a new Jesus in New York. Will you come in? So since I was American and could come from Canada back, so I came back into the New York show.
Mm-hmm.
And then over years, just kept doing it. And then every once in a while, I would leave to do another project or another play, and then I would come back in. And then when it moved to Broadway... I went back into it and opened the Broadway company.
And how did you? Are you starting to think about like? I know it says after about a year after you started working on Another World, John Weitzel, a producer new to the show, told him, "I know how old you really are, and I know that you direct. if you have any interest in directing TV, I'll put you in a training program." And then you say the course lasted 8 weeks. On the day I directed my first show, Weitzel offered me a contract for 2 years. So, was that conversation with him a surprise to you? How far after Godspell are we at this point? And had you started to be thinking about directing? Was it intriguing to you and seeing what directors do and how they do it?
Yeah. Well, first of all. I was always like I put on shows in my basement, right? Mm. The impresario of Jackson Heights.
Right. You grab a bunch of kids and learn a song and kill in an audition, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So I was always like, but didn't realize that. And I also always make Super 8 movies around when I was an actor. I would make backstage movies and stuff. Anyway, I had started to direct theater, probably. In my middle 30s, started direct theater, and then realized, I thought, to be honest, I thought I couldn't beat Juvenile. In other words, I was always looked young, and I was playing these young kids all the time.
Mm.
And then, remember I said these kids are coming out of college, so here comes Bill Hurt, and here comes Kevin Kline, and here comes all these guys, and they're playing 20-year-olds, and I'm still playing 14, 15, because, I had this young face.
Oh.
And I was, so frustrated.
But wait, isn't that a good thing in Hollywood, in show business?
Well, it's a good thing up to a point, and then you become, Eddie Munster or something. you don't grow. It's over for you. So
right.
I was in a play in New York called How I Got That Story. It got rave reviews. It was a big hit, and the playwright asked me to direct a production. So I said, sure. And it was in Canada, strangely enough. So I go up to Canada to direct a production, and I went from being the kid to being the daddy overnight. I came back to New York, and I said, that's it. I'm done. I want to now direct. So
was there any sense of loss or melancholy about like not acting, or you felt like you had done it? It was out of your system. You did it, or you fulfilled yourself?
Kind of. You know, it was actually playing Jesus in Godspell. So you're playing the hero of heroes. You get to die, and you get to sing and dance. So
what's better than that?
You know, I thought, is anything going to be better than this? I don't think so.
I mean, who else are you going to play who's going to top? Maybe John Lennon, but you ended up doing something with that anyway down the road. But you know, so you kind of knew like
it just seemed like
it ain't going to get any better than this.
Yeah, it seemed like the right thing. And this is something I'd been doing now for 20 years already.
Wow.
You know, so it seemed like, oh, this is a better fit, you know. Mm. And so I started directing theater. And then this woman who played my mother on The Guiding Light when I was a kid was now the head writer of a show called Another World at NBC. And so she said, I've got a part I've written for you with you in mind. You've got to do it. And I said, I'm not acting. I'm directing. And she said, we'll give you this more money. We'll give you more money, Finally, I said, okay, look, I'll do it if the producers will let me direct one at the end of like the first year or something.
Yeah.
So they said, okay. So great. I went on the Another World, and I was
What was the part?
Oh, God, it was Chris Chapin. He was a young adventure doctor, sort of. It was,
like a hot young doctor?
A hot young doctor with a little bit of Indiana Jones, strangely enough.
You have a whip and a fedora?
We went to Arizona and did all this kind of finding Indian artifacts and, you know, it was bizarre shit. You know, it was when the soap operas were trying to compete with nighttime, trying to stay alive, really.
But soap opera acting is great training because you got to churn it out every day, and right?
True, 60 pages a day, you know, depending on how much you have to learn, and you do it every day.
And so they don't get the credit sometimes they deserve because you have to be a really good actor to be able to pull that off every day and learn new lines that quickly and work off of, you know, different actors and all that.
It's true. And, you know, in New York, you worked with great actors. When I was on The Guiding Light, James Earl Jones, George Segal, you know, all these terrific actors came through. Billy Dee Williams, I remember.
What was George Segal like off?
Goofy, off funny.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, he's really, really funny.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Very loose.
And so they let you direct.
So they let me direct. That guy, John Weitzel, came in and he said, I was playing opposite a girl who was about 12 years younger than me. But I looked young, remember? So he said, look, I know how old you are. I saw you in Godspell. What are you, 50? I said, no, I'm 35 or whatever. He said, you're too old for this girl. You're out. I said, but he said, no, you're out. I said, well, I have a contract. I'm going to direct. He said, what? I said, yeah, the first year I get to direct. He said, that's pay or play, babe. I said, what? He said, yeah, I can pay you. Never mind.
Wow.
I said, okay. The next day, I get nominated for an Emmy in the under 24 category. I get nominated for an Emmy.
On that show?
Yeah, on that show.
That's awesome.
So he calls me back into his office, and I said, oh, so now I got the Emmy. Now you're not going to fire me. He said, what? No, you're still fired. You're out. He said, but I've been thinking about what you said about you had a directing thing and blah, blah, blah. So I'm going to let you direct one in 6 months. We'll put you on a training thing for 6 months. I said, 6 weeks. I don't have that much time. I'm old, remember? So 6 weeks from that day, I'm directing Another World. It's midnight. It's on tape at this point, right? It's midnight, and, you know, my hair is thin on end. My face is all blotchy. I'm going, two. I mean, three. Give me three. Give me two. Single. No. And he walks in the control room, and he says, I'm putting you on a contract. And I said, but it's midnight, and I'm fucked up. I don't know what I'm doing. He said, no, you know how to talk to the actors, and you have a good camera sense. You just have to get the rhythm of this down,
yeah,
which you'll get.
Was that the hardest part of the learning curve for you for directing, was sort of the technical side of it? Because obviously as an actor, you know how to talk to actors, and you know
right.
what works.
Right.
Was it,
what the scene's about.
Was it somebody... they said, you don't want to work with her. She asks too many questions. Leslie Ann Warren.
Oh, right. That's
and
right.
And you said, I like actors that ask a lot of questions.
Right. I mean, right? You know, and that's the joy of having been an actor, because I see it now, too. I see, you know, big directors who work a lot and they're afraid to talk to people. I watch some directors come on 30 Rock and say to me, how do you talk to Alec?
What?
How do you talk to Alec Baldwin? And these are all busy working directors. I go, what do you mean, how do you talk to Alec Baldwin? You know, like a person, like an actor. You know, they'd be afraid of him. And they don't, but these were directors who had never acted. So it's like they didn't know
right.
how to talk the language.
See? Right.
And they knew that an actor like Alec Baldwin, with his degree of sophistication, and intelligence would say call bullshit if you came up and said, you know, some bad note.
Gave a general direction, like be happier or whatever.
Right. Could you smile more with that line?
Yeah, it's like, what? You're right. And they're going to want to have a conversation.
Why don't you smile on your way out? How about that, pal?
Here's a smile. He'll give you a smile. My foot on your ass.
That's right.
So it sounded like a pretty smooth transition in the directing then, right? Not like, I mean, obviously you had to... You're learning on the job, literally.
Literally learning on the job. And
because that part of calling camera shots would drive me... would be
because you had to do it at that point. You had to do it just like it were live. Do you know what I mean? You have to do just in. Give me two. Give me. You know.
And for people listening, you sit in a control room. You have all these monitors, and every camera is assigned to a monitor with a number. And if there's, we shot a show, a sports comedy show, where we were filming it like essentially like a news show with clips. So there was a lot of calls. So we interviewed NFL and college football directors.
Right.
And we got to listen to their reels. Now, there's like upwards of 20, 25 cameras in a game.
Right.
And this guy's going...
And they got replays.
Give me one. Give me 15. Give me 16. Back to four. And I was just... It was like, do I have 14, 14, 15, 15? It was like...
Am I been 15? Yeah, right.
And it was incredible. So that
it is... It's like, you know, patting your stomach and rubbing your head.
But
and,
you have to anticipate, right?
You do. There is a rhythm to it. And you basically, you know, you take the scene and you... you know, at each place that you're going to call the next cut. So here's what the director has to do in soap operas. And this directing job, by the way, has been devalued for years by people who thought it was nothing. You know, the industry doesn't care. Mm. Only people at home care. But you have to come in with that script blocked out. Where are people going to move, sit, stand, walk, when they're going to get up, et cetera, when they're going to hit each other, you know, whatever the action is. And you're going to now sit in your room at home and figure out what camera is going to take the shot when to show that on television. And what size is that shot going to be? Is it going to be a wide shot, a medium close-up, a two-shot, an over-the-shoulder, all that stuff? So you have to have all that blocked, shot, edited on the page before you walk in. And you can only have about a 5% failure rate. Do you know what I mean? You can clean up about 5% of your shots. But other than that, you do not have time. It's like
so when you're doing this early on, are you standing on the set alone at night just saying, okay, I'm going to have this camera here?
Do a lot of that.
But then over time, you probably don't need to do it, right?
Yeah, because you know the sets and you kind of do it all in your head. But,
right.
But it's great training because, you know, you learn about editing, you learn about cinematography, and you learn about, you know, the emotional value of the scene.
But you're also great with a script, and I've seen you in action, and we've worked together on projects, and because you've acted and you've done all of these things, you can see if there's a hole in a script, you can help. You make a script better. You're not just a director directing it, which is rare.
Right.
You know?
And it shouldn't be rare. It should be just part of the toolkit.
But people don't want to spend the time to learn that part of it. Is that it?
Well, I think it's how people train. You know, it's like I came up through the theater, and I started directing in the theater, where everything is about the playwright, the beats of a scene, how people act, how people work, you know, I mean, how do you break down a scene to find out what it's really about? Mm. How do you get the result you want? And I think a lot of people, which is not to cast asparagus on anybody else's, you know, career path, but you know, other people, you know, they come from the camera side, for example.
Right.
You know, and I'm on a bunch of committees at the Directors Guild of America, and I was talking to a group of people the other night, and I was saying, you know, you have to know what you don't know. So if you come from the camera side and you've never really studied acting, then go take an acting class. Get in there. You know, go to HB Studios.
But even when you say you're from the camera side, there are, on the other side of that camera are actors. So how do you rationalize, well, I don't need to worry about that side of the camera. It's the fact that it's theater shouldn't be any different.
No, it's not. Right, it shouldn't. But it's just that people don't train in the fundamentals of
But the problem with, and I want to get to this in a minute, but when you talk about scripted half-hour comedy, whether it's single camera, no audience, or multi-camera, essentially the other director on the floor generally tends to be one of the main showrunners /writers who are overseeing the writer's room who seem to give the direction in terms of, maybe not with you, but with some directors, I would imagine, for television.
Right.
Because they know what the words are and how they want them to come out of their mouth, right?
Yeah, well, it's sort of a controversial subject in a way, which is that at some point, the writers became the most valuable people to the networks in terms of keeping the quality of the show and, you know, the tenor of the show. And so the writers became the executive producers. And so now you've got a person who is a writer who has been working on that script and is result-oriented. They hear the joke in their head. They hear how they want it to be. And they're now becoming the director, who is a process person. So you might talk to an actor, like we said before, smile more when you say that line, because they don't have that fundamental of how to get an actor,
right?
You know, to say, you know what really tickles his character is something, you know, and then you make it something internal that helps them find it. So that is, you know, we have to a certain degree devalued the sense of certain directing. And I think in comedy it's particularly tough because the writers want to edit it for the jokes and the rhythm of the jokes. And, you know, hey, it's their show.
You said directors can manipulate actors, but I have total faith in them. Having been an actor, I take that with great grain of salt. As an actor, I was a pain in the butt, but that's a good thing. And this gets to what we were talking about, sort of, you want to have someone that wants to have a dialogue with you. And you talked about working with Elaine Stritch on 30 Rock, and you said there's no one like her. She can be spiky, but she's phenomenal. Her choices are completely singular. The key to making Elaine comfortable was bringing her in for the table read, which you don't often do with a guest star, and explain why, how that works generally, and why that was a smart, sounded like a brilliant move on your part.
Well, you know, there's a...
Because this is the thing about directors. You have to be really good with people. Like, you have to, like, you have to be sort of like a salesman in a way to get them to buy the car you want, which is to get the performance you want out of them. So you're part psychologist, right? You're a technician in terms of the lenses and all of that.
You're a lay motivator. Analyst. You're a, you know, you're a father figure. You're you know, a lover.
A taskmaster.
I love what you do. You know, whatever. Because truth, the main word in a director's lexicon is manipulation. But I mean it benevolently. You know, I mean, but it's how do I manipulate? You know, I directed A Few Good Men on Broadway. There were 24 male actors and one female actor. And about the third day of rehearsal, I realized, geez, every one of these guys works differently.
Yeah.
I got to talk to them in their own language and see how do I push the buttons to get what I want. So with a thing like with Elaine, you know, what every show does is when the next script comes out for the following week.
And by the way, she plays Alec Baldwin's character's mother.
Yes.
Brilliant.
So when the script comes out for the following week, the resident cast does a table read so the writers can hear it, they can hear what's funny, what's working, what's not working, and then they have a couple of days to tweak it. Normally, producers don't like to bring in guest actors for that table read because it means paying them. So that's dumb, but that's the way it goes. So with Elaine, we said, well, let's get her in for the table read because she's a theater actor. She hasn't done a lot of television and film. Although she kept saying, I haven't done this. But the truth is, you look at her resume, she had, but it wasn't second nature to her.
Yeah.
And she was appalled by how quickly it went, you know, how the lack of rehearsal time. Because, you know, you're filming a single camera television show like 30 Rock, and in the morning you rehearse the scenes. You rehearse them two or three times, period. And then everybody goes to makeup while you light it, and then you start whacking away at it.
So you felt having her do the table read would put her in a comfortable zone, bring her sort of almost into a theater scenario that she's a theater animal,
right?
So she'd
be comfortable, and she could say at that table read, she could say, I don't know, why am I saying this, Ron? She always called me Ron.
You know, she really did.
And I would say, and for the first, you know, couple of times, I would say, you know, Elaine, it's Don. And I knew her, I'd met her before, you know, I'd known her for years. It's Don. Ah, yeah, right. So Ron, I mean, she just couldn't get it. Anyway, but so that after the table read, she could ask the questions. She could go to the writer. She could go to Tina and say, why am I saying this or doing this? She and Alec could get huddle in a corner and talk about it a little bit.
Right.
Made her more comfortable.
Right.
You know, the whole trick about directing, particularly in television and film where people come in and they're nervous. You know, I mean, people are nervous on stage, but they've been rehearsing for 4 weeks. So they have a solid foundation. But, you know, you've just been cast in a thing, you're coming in, you've never done 30 Rock before, you walk in the set and there's Alec Baldwin giving you the stare, and, you know, Tina Fey and all this, and who knows who else. Could be Jerry Seinfeld, could be the guest, and it'd be amazing people, and people would choke, you know, because, so it's how do you make people comfortable?
So how do you do that? If I come on set and I'm just, like you said, I mean, I'm
Whoa. Yeah. You can get a sense of it right away?
Yeah.
Do you let them have a chit-chat with these with the main stars ahead of time just to break the ice a little bit?
You know, usually there's a sort of a bit of a coffee clutch in the morning. Mm-hmm. So if you're in the first scene, but if you're in the last scene of the day, it's a moving freight train and they just say, come on, you stand over here. You know, you don't have the kind of time.
Yeah.
You know, the truth of the matter is, for me, what it is I tell people, you know, you don't have to be nervous. This is our living room. I know you're not here every day, but we're here every day.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, once I went into the cockpit of a plane as it was flying, they invited me up. And I used to be a very nervous flyer, and I was doing a personal appearance and was in a private plane. Anyway, a CBS plane, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
And they'd come up to the cockpit, and you know, they're steering through the radar, and, you know, they're doing this whole thing, and they're talking about their wives and kids and, you know, having coffee and 7 hours. Oh, these guys are at work. Wait a minute. They do this every day.
It calmed you down.
Know? Yeah, and I thought, you know, for me, it's like a big deal, but for them, that's what they do. So it's the same thing. I would tell people, you know, this you're in somebody's living room. Just relax. What would you do in your living room?
Yeah.
And also try and keep my manner as offhand as possible. Like, I have worked for directors who made it seem like it was life or death. Like, if I didn't get it right away, they were going to kill me. Mm. You know, they get...
As an actor.
Yeah, as an actor.
And how would you deal with that as an actor so it didn't affect you?
You know,
It would.
You know, you have to fake it.
Yeah.
You know, you just... You know,
like
and I was a kid to boot, you know, so you just had to say, okay, you know.
Well, you have a great way about you. I've seen you in action too, and you're a little bit more like when you got to go, but still, you have this very soothing. It's going to be an anal probe. It's going to be fine.
That's right. It won't hurt much. Just the first few inches. But you know, you have to be patient, and you have to know that if you've cast well, even if they come onto that rehearsal and you only got a half hour, 15 minutes, whatever it is, and they're bobbling it, you know, or they're having trouble. You have to know, we cast well, this person's a good actor, they'll get it.
Yeah.
By the time they've come through hair and makeup and we're lit, they'll get it. And right now they're just nervous. So I might take them aside, I might, you know, let them have a chat with Tina or something, you know, anything that I can glean that will make them relax. You know, once I was doing a Cosby episode and Sheila E. came on to be a guest star, you know, from Prince's band.
Mm.
And Sheila E. was late. And she came running into the studio, she was about an hour late. She got screwed up in traffic, whatever, planes.
Mm-hmm.
She comes running into the studio. She's wearing these long high heels. And Cosby says to her, why don't you, go to a wardrobe and put some, you know, sneakers on. And she says, no, this is fine. He said, well, you don't want to rehearse in those shoes. She said, no, this is fine. He says, go to wardrobe and get some sneakers that you can work in. She said, you sure? And he said, do you know where you are? And she said, home. And he said, there you go.
Oh, wow.
And that was, I went, up. That's right.
Yeah.
You know, make them feel at home.
Have you had situations where you just couldn't get through to an actor and as a director? And how did you ever get through to that person? How do you sort of get there?
Well, I've had both experiences. One is, yes, I couldn't get through to them. And then, you know, ultimately poked and prodded enough, but found a way.
Do you want to mention a name?
No, but I've also had actors where I've got, I can't get through to this person. I just let him hang himself. What can I tell you? I'll have to cut around it, you know?
Yeah.
Because no matter what I say, you know, sometimes an actor will come in with a fixed thing and they get scared and they can't get off it.
Yeah.
You know, they're unwilling to take a leap and try something
in front
of the camera.
You've talked about directing comedy. And you say to people, I keep telling them to look at Preston Sturges movies. He'll do a whole scene without a cut in it. It's a riot. You know, he's had screwball comedies like The Lady Eve, Sullivan's Travels.
Sure.
He's got everybody interacting with everybody else, and it's funnier than cutting to a close-up for a joke. I'm fascinated by that. Explain why that can work. Is it almost like that scene... what's the scene with the Marx Brothers where they all end up piling into that
the state room.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's just a lock-off shot.
Yeah,
and
right.
It's all
it's
happening
chaos.
In front. Yeah.
Right.
And this is something, it sounds like, that you were trying to tell younger directors in terms of how to don't rely too much on cutting and editing to get the joke.
Right. Well, you know, comedy, like actually drama acting as well, but comedy works in reaction too, frequently. You know, there'll be a joke, and the joke may be funny, but depending on how I respond to that joke, Like, you know, if I make a face or I, you know, however I react, that's part of the joke. It's like, oh, it's kind of always a 1-2 punch. Right. People relating to each other. So I always say a 2-shot's going to be funnier than a single because I'm going to see not only the guy telling the joke, but I'm going to see the other guy respond to it.
Right.
And that tells the audience something about how funny that joke is. It's
right.
not in a vacuum.
Right.
And even though you're playing a scene and you cut from this guy to this guy, that joke is existing in a single frame. Doesn't mean it can't be funny. But if I see that joke in a 2-shot, I can tell the audience why it's funny by the way that character reacts. Or think of, you know, strictly old school comedy. You know, the guy goes riding along on a bicycle and he goes outside the frame line and you hear crash.
Right.
Now, you know, that's funny. You didn't even have to see him fall down. So it's the reaction to something. So when you've got a bunch of actors in a scene and watch them all play off each other, react to each other, your comedy multiplies exponentially by the number of people in the scene.
But, and why do you feel the need to explain that to directors? Are you finding that they, is it sort of like a crutch that they want to cut so much within the scene?
Well, I think so. I think particularly with writer directors, you know, the joke is so important to them. They want all the jokes in close up.
Right.
So they really have no, if they get in the edit room, they know they're never going to lose a joke because they've got it in close up. I understand that, but you know, it's like we'll fix it in the mix in a music session.
Yeah.
You know, it's like as long as I got everything in close up, I can edit it however I want.
Right.
But if you can catch what I call, you know, lightning in a bottle by having it happen, you're always, I think it's always funnier. Not that I'm not going to go shoot the close ups in case, so I'm sitting in the edit room. If I say I wish I had a close up of that, I've got it. But it's that Preston Sturges thing that of comedy happening all at once between the people involved.
Was the Cosby Show sort of the biggest I don't want to say learning curve because you already knew your stuff, but like was that sort of the experience that sort of brought the best out of you and sort of really brought you to another level, you think?
It did. You know, I would say working with again, all his personal trials and tribulations and problems aside currently, just taking the man as a comedian and as an artist on television, he had a very restless sort of mind. He never liked to do the same thing twice.
If you're taking a scene a second time.
Right. He always wanted to do something different, even get up and walk somewhere else or obviously say different lines or go off on a tangent or...
Isn't that funny, though, coming from a comedian who has a set act that goes out and does that act over and over again, usually verbatim with the same cadence?
It is, because what he said was, he said, look, I'm a jazz musician. I will play the chords, meaning the story, the same way every time. I'll give you the values of the story, but the melody, I'm going to jam that every time. I want to riff that every time. I want to improv that like a jazz musician.
To keep it fresh for him,
I would imagine. Absolutely.
Right.
And to surprise get the other actor to go, boop, boing, and come back with something different.
Right.
So it was at first really disconcerting because I would go on and say, Dr. Cosby, you were sitting down before, and now you're standing up when you say that line. And I got a camera for the sit-down. He said, well, get a camera for the stand-up. And I'd say, okay, yeah, well, you know. And so,
you have to start setting cameras up everywhere because he wants to hang from the ceiling.
It's true, he would say, you know. And then, so finally I said to him, look, I'll make a deal with you. You have to give me a roadmap every day. We come in and we rehearse. If you're going to change it Wednesday from what you did Tuesday, just let me know. And I'll change my shot so that I'll always go into the control room on show night with a roadmap. Now you say, then you just get on the talk back and say, I'm changing this now, I'm gonna do this, and I'll deviate from the roadmap. But, you know, 65% of that's gonna be on the roadmap and I'll be, you know, less Spilkes here, okay? So he said, okay, deal the cards, you've got it, we'll do that. So I said, okay. So the show got tighter, but.
Again, this is like a psychologist, like this is incredible.
Psychology.
We're not even talking about dealing with the actor as an actor. We're talking about dealing with the actor star as a producer, also a director.
Yeah, and an icon, a national monument at that point.
Right, and manipulating him in a good way get the result.
To get what I need.
To give him the best result and show him
best light. And what I said to him was, I said, can I talk to you frankly? It's like my third episode. He said, yeah, deal the cards. I said, the show looks like shit.
You said that to Bill Cosby?
And he took his cigar out and he said, it does. And I said, yeah, it does, because, you know, you change it up every time. And that's when he gave me the jazz musician analogy. And that's when I gave him, okay.
Well, hang on. When you said it looked like shit, meaning not the set itself or whatever, but just it was sort of in terms of cuts and shots all over the place.
Because he's all over the place and he's changing it all the time. So cameramen are wild. Nobody can write shots down. Nobody knows what he's going to do.
And is that affecting the story and the delivery of the jokes and the reception of the jokes, you
think? Yeah. I mean, not to the audience in the house, you know, where we shot in front of a live audience. They would hear the jokes and laugh. But in terms of getting it right on camera and getting it nice, you know, and making it work, I didn't have the pieces that I thought would make it better on the tube.
So he takes a cigar out of his mouth and says, you do, and then what happens?
And so I told him, I said, you know, because you're all over the place and, you know, it's hard to take a shot. And then the edit is like, we just have to play catch up and kind of make it work in the edit. And that's when he said about the jazz musician thing. And I said, look, I'm a musician. My parents are jazz musicians. I will play with you. I will jam with you, but if you're going to play the chords, I really need to know the chords are going to be the same. And I said that thing about it, if you're going to change it on Wednesday from Tuesday, just tell me, and I'll change along with you.
Yeah.
And then, like I say, if I go into the booth with 65% on paper, I'm ahead of the game already than what I got now, which is zip, you know, free for all, like a football match.
Shitting your pants as you walk to the edit bay.
So he said, okay, and it got better. But what I learned, and what I learned from him, because then we would do things like he would say, oh, hey, I got an idea for the tag. Put all the cameras out in the backyard, and we're going to shoot it out there. And one on Dougie Doug, and one on me, and one on Felicia. And okay. And then it would be fun, because he was letting us in on the thing, and everybody would kind of warm to the idea that we're flying by the seat of our pants. And what I learned after 2 years of working with Bill was anything can be shot. Because every week we finished the show, and every week we had a show on the air. So I realized that there's nothing to be afraid of. There's nothing that can't be photographed, shot,
staged. As long as there's dialogue and planning and communication.
That's right.
Between the principals.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
but you can go free for all. You know, once you've set all that up and it's an agreement, now when you want to go free for all, I'm ready to go.
So you must have taken then that experience. That had to make you better. So the next thing that you go into, you've got these little tricks in your hip pocket from what you had just done with Cosby, and go, I'm going to do something here that someone hasn't done.
For
obviously,
sure.
You're not the kind of guy that's going to just do something for the sake of doing it if it makes sense within the overall.
Right, yeah. But so a whole bag of tricks, plus also the biggest bag of tricks, which was that my confidence increased. You know, because directing is, you know, in the big time, is sort of like the whistle a happy tune theory. It's like playing the palace or something. You know, you're just an asshole from Queens, you know. So, but you have to go, and collect that. I'm at the Oscars, you know.
How did you do that the first day on set with Cosby?
Whistle a happy tune, and no one ever knows, I'm afraid. You know, you fake it, you know, because if you don't, you know, you'll turn it into a quivering mass of jello, and they'll send you home.
And they sense it, and then they seize on you.
Right.
So you just take it with you, take it in, and then...
Yeah, in my early career, there are times where I'd go into the men's room and say, I need to take a five. Let's all take a five, because I'd be stumped by something that was happening, or I hadn't worked something out, or my shot was wrong, whatever. I'd say, I'd take a five, and I would go literally into the men's room and go, oh, what am I going to do? Until I could come up with a solution.
That's awesome.
And then I'd come back... You know, whistling, go, okay, now we're going to do this. We're going to change this. I'm going to do this.
Some of the greatest shows created in a men's handicap stall.
That's right.
I go into a men's handicap stall before I perform, usually at a club. It's the only place I can get, like, complete focus for, like,
and
just
quiet.
2 minutes.
Yeah.
Just 2 minutes. So have some music.
Right.
And I'm kind of, it all kind of comes together. And then it's, you know.
Yeah.
Difference for you as a director, you know, you're going from, we're talking about a multi-camera for those listening, that generally means when you hear a studio audience laughing, that's called a multi-camera sitcom, to a single camera, which is shot like film, which is like 30 Rock, where you don't hear an audience. And also you shot drama. Are your skill sets different? Like, let's talk about single camera versus multi-camera. Obviously, how you deal with people is going to be the same regardless of what you're doing.
Right.
But what are the different skill sets required of the different formats?
Well, single camera, you know, you have the whole world to shoot in terms of your staging and stuff. Let me back it up. Multi-camera is done on almost like a stage set. So it's like going to see a play at the theater.
And then, but there are cameras on that stage.
Right, there are cameras in front of that proscenium. So it's all kind of very presentational, and it all lays out in that way. When you're shooting a single camera, there's a fourth wall that comes in. You're in a real room. It's a four-walled room rather than a three-walled room, like on a stage set. So you have to incorporate that fourth wall. So that means your geography in terms of how you shoot and how you make sense of the world in terms of how you shoot. I'm going to it and bore your audience, but...
No, this is why I do my show. I don't give a shit if they're bored or not.
Right. You know, that's the thing you have to incorporate technically. That's the difference there.
But wait, you say there's that fourth wall.
Right.
But isn't there a fourth wall with a three? Is it because the audience is there reacting?
Yeah, the audience is breaking
that fourth wall?
No, the audience is the fourth wall. And think of it as literally it's a left wall, a right wall, and an upstage center wall connecting those two. It's three walls, right? So your cameras are down on the what would be the curtain line in a theater.
Right.
And they are taking the pictures.
Right.
And the staging conforms to presenting in that way. When you add the fourth wall, in other words, now I'm going to take that audience wall where the cameras sit and I'm going to close it up like a real room in a real house. It has four walls now. That those cameras now, where do you put them? How do you orient the audience into this room? How do you make them see? And that's what in film technique is called the master shot. So in the master shot, you have you, me, another fellow sitting here, and that's the three of us in the master shot. And then that becomes the audience's orientation. We're in a studio, we have two microphones, we have a back wall and a clock. That's what they see. And now, but if I want to turn around on the third guy over there, that's the fourth wall. I have to incorporate that. And the geography of the shooting between how people look at each other is based on the master, if that makes any sense. The other thing is that in multicam, you have a thing which I call the tyranny of the joke, which is that you have a live audience in front of you, and you have to be funny. They're sitting there. It's like you going in a club.
Right.
You know when you're dying, they're not laughing.
Right, right.
So if you do take one of the scene, and the audience is there, and this joke falls flat, that thing doesn't happen, doesn't land, then take two, everybody's going to run up and try to come up with a bunch of different jokes to get them to laugh.
Right.
So we change the jokes around. The actors have to learn new jokes.
Right.
It all happens very quickly. And so you're tailoring that show to the audience that's sitting there. Whereas in 30 Rock, it's just whether the writers think it's funny and the actors think it's funny. We're performing for ourselves. Maybe
so
the crew
So it's easier
laugh.
To shoot in that sense.
Because it's easier to shoot. You don't have the tyranny.
The changes aren't.
Yes.
As an actor, when I audition and I've trained as an actor for comedy, I've been told if it's a multicam, you want your pacing to be faster. I don't want to use the word bigger, but you want to sort of you can be a little bit smaller in your acting, a little more intimate. If it's a single camera, because it's like film.
That's
Why
true.
Is that?
Well, and it's like stage too. It's again, you're playing. You know, filmed in front of a live audience, and everybody knows that.
Right.
And you are playing for that audience, so that the style of sitcom, which is unchanged since the I Love Lucy days, really, I mean, is more sophisticated, you know, feathered here and there. But basically, it's unchanged as a format.
Mm.
And they were playing for that live audience. And so, like in the theater, you know, you're pushing it out a little bit more. Things are a little broader.
Right.
They are a little bigger.
You're going to play to the back of the house.
And you're going to hit the joke
because,
you know, you want to make sure that audience gets it.
Mm.
And even though it's on camera, and sometimes it gets a little too big because you are playing too much the house, and you have to dial it back a little
bit.
Whereas single camera presents you with a real world. There's no audience laughing. It just has to be funny in itself and by itself. You can be more naturalistic.
And you directed the incredible Burt Wonderstone with Steve Carell. And so on the film level, are you closer to a single camera directing experience then? And now you're working with locations and bigger sets and more people. And so what's your adjustment? I came to see you when you were shooting in that looked like jungle scene.
Right.
And on the Warner Brothers lot.
Yeah.
And it was just, even though I've acted and I've been in things, it's always just crazy to see just think something being created out of nothing. But What's the adjustment there? Like, what do you have to call on in terms of your strongest or biggest strengths on a film set versus one of these TV sets?
Well, first of all, you're dealing with a larger format, a larger canvas. The heads are going to be, well, you know, in the theater, they're going to be, you know, yeah, gigantic, feet, like yeah. the whole thing. You can both play things wider, talk about playing with more people in a scene, stuff like that, but you can play things wider. And when you come in for the close-up, you know, you don't want to be so ludicrously large, even though it's a comedy, unless that's, of course, what the character is. You know,
right.
If your character's playing Bozo the Clown, I suppose you can do that.
Yeah.
But, so again, the naturalism factor gets much more important there. Also, you know, it's the stakes are higher because you're doing a motion picture. TV has a because you want to get as many viewers as you can on television, has a slightly lowest common denominator feel to the comedy.
Mm.
You got advertisers to please.
Yeah.
You want to deliver the largest number.
Yeah.
You know, here come the ratings. Whereas a movie, you can be much more true to your school in a way, and you have to be more legit about. The stakes are higher for you to be better.
Yeah.
It's a bigger sandbox. Now with the new sort of golden age of television and all these terrific shows being produced for cable, they're giving the movies a run for the money. People
right.
would say, I'd rather watch, you know.
Something on Amazon or Netflix
right.
or FX.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible.
And you see, if you watch the newer shows and the newer comedies on Netflix and Amazon, the playing has become more naturalistic. And, you know, it's a little more movie-like, like I Love Dick and those things are just a little.
Even the commercials. I go up for commercial acting. Commercial acting used to be before my time. I said, this is Tide and you're going to love it. Now it's all, they want it super low-key. Very conversational. VOs I go in for, same thing.
Totally real person.
They want it like, you know, hey, I got a stain. I need some Tide. It's like a lot of like sarcasm. It's like it's completely different. And but some hold up, you know. Like I caught part of a rerun of Friends. And it was, the acting was well done. And this is when they were young in the series too. You think, oh, you see like the acting and you really, it was... They trusted the material, trusted the jokes.
Yeah.
The they had a great chemistry, which is the importance of the two shot and the master sort of seeing all
to
of that.
Be together,
yeah.
But it's true, and that stuff. Let's face it, comedy, all comedy, the best comedy has to come from truth.
Right.
It has to be truthful.
Right.
So something like Friends, you know, they got to land somewhere that people respond
to. Right. Coming out of a situation that's real to them. So you've got. I want to tell people you're. You're performing again as a musician.
Yeah.
And I got to see you,
and
it was great. Tom Fontana, who's been on the show, we talked about how great you were.
Oh, wow.
And you did it with Paul Schaefer and Jane Krasinski and all these other...
Jane Krakowski,
I'm sorry, and other great names. What are you going to... Is that a regular thing? Tell people when they're going to see when they can see you?
I am going back. I'm going to go December 8th and 9th. Going to go sooner, but I have other TV stuff to do.
Mm.
December 8th and 9th. In October 9th, which is John Lennon's birthday, you know, I directed a Broadway show called Lennon about John Lennon. We're going to do an evening with the original cast of that show, Lennon, at 54 Below. And
Yoko loved that show that you did. You're a huge Lennon fan.
Yeah, she was helpful.
It ran 40, 50 episodes of
performances. Yeah.
But why didn't that work in your mind? I know you said the critics hated it. And it was his music put to...
Right,
you know,
his solo catalog. In fact, every word on the stage was out of John's mouth. Even scenes that you saw. What I did was I took interviews with John where he would describe what Paul said to me and I would make a scene out of it. But what I wanted is I wanted everything on the stage to be out of John's mouth.
Mm.
Because as a John Lennon fan, I feel the only thing I can have is him.
Mm.
So let's have as much him as I can. So Yoko loved that idea, and that's how I put it together. The critics generally, by and large, failed to appreciate it.
Mm.
Audiences gave it standing ovations every night. Mm. People would go in intermission and buy tickets to come back for another performance. You know, it was kind of radical in that it wasn't exactly linear, and it was nine people playing John Lennon, men, women, Asian, African American.
Why did you make those choices of different?
Because I am he as you are, he as you are me, and we are all together.
Oh, so you wanted?
You know, I wanted it to be. You know, imagine all the people.
Yeah.
You know, so I just felt that was, and his magic number was 9. He felt 9 was his special number. He was born on the 9th. 9 was, you know, number 9. He was very, so I had 9 people play Lennon, and each person played a different facet, because what I discovered as I went to really research it was that John tried on all these different personalities, from tough Liverpool rocker on the docks, tough kid.
You mean in his performance?
In his life.
The way he carried himself.
Art student, sensitive art student, was going to be an artist, painter, writer, revolutionary, guru, Beatle, of course.
Yeah.
You know, and he was all these different facets. So it was like trying to get each person to play another facet of that.
How was Yoko to work with? Collaborative?
She was very collaborative. She was astonishing. I was very nervous about it and thought, oh my God, you know. And she gave me free rein. She opened up a lot of their stuff to me to look at.
Well, that says a lot about you, because she can be very, rightfully so, protective of his image and his music.
It was great. She loved it. She came to every performance. And someone said, was she like checking up on you? I said, no, she's hanging out with John.
Yeah.
She wants to be here.
Well, you got to do a passion project, and it was successful in that sense, and like people loved it, and that's all that matters.
That's all that matters.
Yeah.
You know, finally.
So December 8th and 9th.
At 54 Below.
54 Below.
In Manhattan.
And you're going to have a different group of people with you?
Might mix it up a little bit. Yeah. We'll see. You know, we did some stuff from 30 Rock last time, and that's why I had Jane Krakowski and Jeff Richmond with me. Johnny Miller will be back playing bass. You know, we'll see. I'm still working on what the format's going to be.
And you're directing show Instinct.
Instinct with Alan Cumming at CBS. Comes on in the fall. It's a terrific show.
Yeah.
He plays a detective who's a former CIA spy who was brought into the New York City detective force to...
Does he do any musical numbers?
Well, not yet anyway. You never know. You never know. But he's terrific in the pilot, and so that's happening. And I'm going to do this show called Young Sheldon, which is a spinoff from The Big Bang, about the character Sheldon at age 10 in Texas. And
you're going to shoot it in Texas?
No, it shoots in L.A. for Texas.
But wow.
And another thing called L.A. to Vegas that Will Ferrell's company is producing, which is... a funny show about a gambling junkets that ferry people in little airplanes from L.A. to Vegas.
That's funny.
To gamble. And it's a funny
script. What network is that?
That's Fox.
Oh, cool. Are you going back to L.A. to work? I thought you were staying here.
No, I am staying here, but you know, I go with my ticket home. As long as you give me my ticket home, I'll come do the job.
All right. Well, we got to do more. You're going to come on again, because there's other stuff I want to talk to you about.
But I want to see where you got my dossier.
I got it. It's the least I can do. I can't just, you know, I got to pretend like I care. No. You're the best.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Paul, this is a great thing.
Don Scardino. If you watched it, he directed it. It's pretty simple. And December 8th and 9th, see him at 54 Below if you're in New York City. He's really great. And he still looks 14, don't you think? Dennis, don't you think? I'm asking the producer. You look like a 14-year-old kid. Creepy 14-year-old kid.
Definitely creepy.
And
if this were 14, I'd run away.
All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening.
A Westwood One podcast production.